Before she had set off in the car, clutching the serviette on which Rosetta had drawn a crude map, she had momentarily wobbled and called Alex, thinking she would prefer not to go alone. But she cut the call before there was any answer, in case word got back to Tom. She would rather risk being alone than have to deal with his incredulity. The last light was fading from the sky, and the garage, set away from the main road down a rough, narrow path, was quiet and remote. It felt almost like a trap. She made her way past the clump of trees, grown much bigger now, where Ray had seen the fox, careful of her footing on the rubbly ground. She was going to find a lead, she was sure of it. Then Tom would see how good the technology was. The police would be impressed, maybe even offered to buy the tech, and then Carter would forgive her. But most importantly, she would have helped to find Isabel and catch the Mizpah murderer. Justice for Emma at last. The yellowy glow from the yard lamp had long since gone. She flicked the light on her comset, which gave out a bright white beam, and with some difficulty yanked open the door into the garage that Ray had used for shelter. She lay down, too eager for information to worry about her coat on the grimy ground. The smell of oil was much stronger than she had caught in Ray's memories. Peering out from beneath the cracked wood, she angled her head down so that she could shine her light across the yard and look out at the same time. But she did not see what she had expected. Her sight became refracted, as if she had a migraine halo, and split her vision into two, as if the past and the present were converging and both happening simultaneously. She saw the yard as it was when she had arrived, and then she saw the yard as it had been the night Rosetta had been there. Then the present day faded away, and there was only the past. Right in front of her eyes, just beyond the garage door, she could see the tire of a car. She craned her neck to see more. The paintwork was a bright cherry red, radiant in the white light of her comset. The next moment, a half brick banged the garage door, making her heart burst into speed, the adrenaline flushing through her system. She glanced over to the far side of the yard, and as she did so, Jennifer Bosanquet came running out, her feet bare, stumbling on the rubble in the yard, her tiny frame swathed in white fabric like an old-fashioned nightdress. She ran up to the door, right in front of Kira, half a metre away, separated by only a few centimetres of rotten wood, and then cowered down behind the car, hiding. She was in Kira's beam, but she didn't seem to see the light. Kira's chest grew tight. The bees, ever present these days, made every nerve in her body hurt as the anxiety travelled through her body like electricity. She briefly closed her eyes, but when she opened them again, the car and the woman were still there. Her mind was reeling. Her instincts were urging her to rescue the woman, but her psychology training telling her this wasn't what it seemed. Next moment, the garage door opposite burst open. A hooded man appeared and honed in on the terrified woman. She whimpered,
"I'm not her. I'm Jenny. I'm Jenny."
Kira knew what would happen next. She had already seen it. This would be the last time anyone saw Jennifer Bosanquet alive.
"But I'm Jenny,"
the woman cried more desperately. The killer came really close and punched Jennifer once, hard. Kira, in her stunned confusion, could no longer stop herself from remaining still. She thought of Rosetta's courage and grabbed a half brick, the only weapon available. She knew in a matter of seconds he would be bending over Jennifer's body, picking her up and putting her in the boot of his car. She burst out of the door, brick raised above her head, ready to strike, ready to fight for Jennifer's life. But the yard was empty. There was no car, no woman, no killer. Kira ran over to the garage opposite and wrestled the rusty hinged door open. Shining her comset torch in, she could see no one. The garage seemed to swirl around her and she staggered back into the yard and slumped down to the rough ground, sweating, heart pounding, limbs weak, wondering what the hell she was thinking. This had all happened 15 years ago. but it had all seemed so real. Her chest was heaving now, a hive full of honey, unable to let any oxygen in. Why the hell hadn't she brought Alex with her? She tried her number, but there was no reply. They were probably in the thick of it now in the hub, last-minute leads, desperate to make the next few hours count. Midnight was beckoning, the hour of Isabel Marsden's death. For a split second, she considered ringing Tom. "Dial Jimmy." Her words shattered the eerie silence. "Jimmy, pick up, pick up," she urged. It went straight to auto message. He wasn't speaking to her. She couldn't blame him. "Jim, please. I'm freaking out here. Something weird's going on. I saw something, but it happened years ago. I don't feel so good, Jimmy. I need you. I'm sorry. You were right. This tech is making me... Just call me back." She wished she could have said, "Come and get me." She was on her own. The light from the call went out and she was surrounded by stifling darkness. She moved to get up, her chest still tight, and pulled herself up to her feet, wheezing. Her head exploded into a sharp ache and dizziness which caught her off balance. She needed to get back to her car, which she had left on the main road. But to get there, she would have to walk down to the entrance of the yard, a tapering alleyway with tumble-down brick walls riven with buddleia on either side. The plants had been left to grow wild and now formed a tunnel of dead brown spear-shaped heads and branches wavering in the cool breeze. Kira stumbled to the alley, desperate to get out of the yard. Up ahead, at a distance, she saw the bright lights of intermittent cars driving past, but they were suddenly blacked out by a solid, shadowy mass beyond the thin branches, which waved violently as the wind began to increase. She stopped still, straining to see what it was. As her eyes grew used to the dark, her heart nearly stopped. A figure stood motionless, silhouetted against the distant streetlights, blocking the path. In his hand, she could see a hacksaw, the angular, trapezoid shape visible in outline. Was it Lomax, escaped again? Was he going to make good on his promise to her? Who was it? "Jesus, no," she cried, frantically looking for an escape route. She switched her light off to make her position less obvious. Adrenaline made her legs feel useless. Her mind flailed, and in her panic, to get away from him, she retreated a few metres back down the alley towards the garages, and then realised her mistake as he moved towards her, maintaining the distance between them. Could she run into one of the garages to hide, wait until he came further into the yard, and then make a break for it? At least that way she might have a chance to escape. But she knew he would move the second she did. He would be faster, on her before she even had a chance to hide. She eyed the hacksaw again and willed her body to do what she needed it to do, urging her legs to function, her eyes to guide her. The second she moved her body, he burst into action and darted towards her like a lion on a gazelle. She scrambled her way to one of the rotten wooden doors, sliding on rocks and tripping over rubble. She heard him getting closer, the sound of his feet pounding the concrete. Darting into one of the garages, she caught her hand against the rusted lock, the pain shooting up her arm. Crouching down in a dark corner, she tried hard to stifle her laboured breathing, desperate to suck in the air as she shuddered in fear. There was an almighty crash as he slammed his body against the wooden door. She got up onto her haunches like an animal ready to launch herself, to fight whatever it was that she was about to face. Nothing happened. She waited for another minute, the adrenaline burning her muscles, a growling fear in the pit of her stomach. There was no movement. She slowly stood up, her body tensed, and listened, scanning the air for any sound or smell that would tell her danger was near. Then she moved towards the door in the pitch black, one footstep at a time, hearing nothing, seeing nothing. She reached out for the door, gearing herself up to to going back out to the courtyard. Her fingers made contact with the splintered wood and she pushed it open in trepidation and peeked out. She could see no one and launched into a run. A loud animal roar burst into her ears and he came from behind, hurtling after her. She caught her foot on a brick and fell, tumbling over and over, banging her hip and elbow, cracking her wrist and grazing her face, until she righted herself and stood and moved off again in one swift motion. Where was he? Who was he? She hurried towards the alleyway and the lights of the main road beyond the branches. She hit her car at speed and grabbed the handle, but for some reason the door wouldn't open. A shooting pain electrified her damaged wrist as she struggled with it. She heard him then, gaining on her. She tugged at the handle again, frantically pulling with short, snappy looks back and forth to see how close he was. There was no reassuring clunk as the central locking responded to her handprint. Her face burned from the contact with the ground. Her wrist throbbed. He stood 2 meters away, smaller than she had imagined. It's not Lomax, but nonetheless terrifying, waving the hacksaw at her. His face was a dark space, a grim reaper's aspect. Of course, the oil and grime from the floor of the garage. He started moving slowly towards her, nothing between them, nowhere to hide. She wiped her hand furiously on her jeans, spitting on them and rubbing again, then grabbed the handle. He dived towards her, but the door opened halfway. She quickly tried to force her body into the narrow gap, but he was too fast and he was upon her. He slammed against the car door, banging it against her head as she tried to climb in. Lights burst around her vision. Somehow, she managed to push him off. His hands hit the window between them and the hacksaw cracked against the glass. Her foot was still on the ground outside the car. She was stunned, her head throbbing. His face was so close to hers now that she could hear his grunts as he forced the car door against her, the pain in her leg excruciating. He gritted his teeth together, spittle at the corner of his mouth. One of his eyes was closed over, the skin around it ruched. Her body trapped, she did the only thing possible and pressed her heel down as hard as she could on his foot. It was not particularly forceful. She hadn't been able to get much momentum, but he yelped and released the pressure on the door briefly. It was enough to give Kira space to get herself into the car. Once in the seat, she went to pull the door closed, but his hand darted in and he grabbed her by a fistful of hair, pulling her head out of the car and slamming the door on it. "I'm going to take your hands," he whispered. As she lost consciousness, the last thing she saw was the hacksaw. Chapter 35. Wednesday, 7th of February, 8:36 p.m. Kira screamed when she heard the thumping on the window of the car. It was still dark. How long had she been out? She brought her arms up to protect herself. Her hands. She examined them, trembling before her eyes, relieved. Kira! Jimmy stood on the grass verge outside, lit by the headlights of his own car. His curly hair was poking out from under a cap, his palms pressed against the glass. "You okay? Open the door." With a shaking voice, he ordered the car to unlock the doors and half climbed, half fell out onto the grass. She grabbed Jimmy's arms and pulled herself up and held onto him. "Has he gone? Has he gone?" She glanced around in the darkness, eyes wide. He patted her back uncertainly. "You're okay. There's no one here." Jimmy had come for her. He cared about her. They were friends, for heaven's sake. He hadn't meant to reject her. He'd only been concerned about her, hadn't he? "I'm sorry. About everything. About work. About pushing too hard," she began. "It doesn't matter now," he reassured her. She loosened her grip on him. "What are you doing here? How did you find me?" "You mean, what are you doing here? I got your message and I was worried. I used the tracker I put on your car." "I'd forgotten about that." It seemed like such a basic experiment now. So much had changed since then. She finally let go and sat back down on the car seat, door wide open, feet on the grass beneath. "You sure you're okay?" Jimmy asked. "I'm all right now." She ran her hand across her forehead. "I'm glad you're here. What on earth were you doing out here on your own at this time of night?" She examined her hands again, relieved. She thought about Riley, the little boy with no mother. She steeled herself for his reaction. "This is where Ray Clark saw the killer."
"What makes you think that?" he asked quietly.
"Rosetta McGuire called me. She was a witness to Jennifer Bosanquet's murder. The police overlooked her, took her for a junkie, but she told me everything."
"About this place?" Kira nodded.
"Does Tom know you were here?"
She shook her head.
"He doesn't believe anything I say. He thinks I've lost it." Jimmy came around the other side of the car and got in and closed the door. Kira immediately shut her door too and locked the car.
"Let's wait here until you feel a bit better, and then I'll follow you back to yours. Make sure you get home safe."
"Do you think I'm mad, Jim?" She kept her eyes on the dashboard, the soft blue glow of the lights familiar and comforting.
"It's been a rough time. Don't worry about Tom Morgan."
Tears of relief prickled her eyes.
"But I think you have let this get the better of you."
She didn't want to hear it and opened her mouth to speak, a sob escaping.
"Jimmy, I'm so sorry about everything. I didn't want to fall out with you."
"It's fine. Don't worry."
She looked up at him now. "Thanks for coming for me. I didn't..." she began, but she was interrupted when her comm set rang. Why was her mother ringing this late? She sniffed and wiped her nose with the back of her hand.
"Hi, Mum. Everything all right?"
she said, trying to sound more cheerful than she felt.
"Molly's not back. I don't know what to do. She's not answering."
Kira sighed heavily and put her hand on the dashboard in front of her. How much more pressure could she take?
"You know what she's like, Mum. She'll come back once she's got over..."
Her eyes flicked to Jimmy and back.
"The row last night." "No, Kira. This is different. That was a lot for her to take in yesterday. I don't know..." "Mum!"
She hadn't meant to snap at her. Jimmy directed his gaze out of the window.
"Mum," she said more calmly. "She'll be back in the morning. She will. Try not to let it get to you."
She ended the conversation, her mother still anxious, but Kira was too exhausted to give her more comfort. She should be worried about herself right now, the things she was seeing, the man at the garage, not her niece's tantrums or her mother's worries.
"What happened here?"
Jimmy pointed to the greys on her face, concerned.
"Do you know your face is bleeding?"
She flicked down the mirror behind the visor and checked her reflection.
"I fell over."
Was that a shadow on the back seat? She looked around and then back again to the mirror. She must have imagined it. She touched her face, it stung. The blood was gritty on her fingers. She flipped the visor back up.
"What were you thinking, coming out here in the middle of nowhere on your own? Why didn't you ask me to come with you?"
"I saw him here," she blurted.
"Who did you see?"
She couldn't look at him, but she could hear the anxiety in his voice.
"A man. He tried to attack me."
She looked out of the car window.
"I don't know where he went."
Jimmy was silent.
"What if it was him? The Mitzpah murderer?"
"He was here. Jesus! Tell Tom," he urged. "There might be some evidence."
"I said I saw him. I don't know if he was here. Not really."
Her voice shook with nerves. She turned to face him now.
"Jimmy, I'm seeing things. All sorts of things. I don't know what's real."
"It might have been the killer. How do you know he wasn't there? Would he have come back after all this time? I mean, He killed someone the other day. It could have been him, right? Did he believe her?
I saw Jennifer Bosanquet, one of the victims.
She searched his face for a reaction.
She's been dead 15 years.
She groaned and covered her face with her hands.
I saw the man who took her, but I don't think he was there. I'm losing it, Jim. I am going mad. Tom's right.
She reached up and put her hands on the wheel. Kira, this has got to stop, he said gently. She knew he was looking at her, but she kept her eyes fixed on the windscreen.
But I'm so close, Jim. Isabel, she'll die tonight if I don't find some way of...
He reached his hand over and put it on hers. You're making yourself ill. This is the furthest we have ever come with Cassandra. You've proved it works. You've proved yourself. Feeling his touch broke her down, and she let out a wail.
I couldn't save her, Jimmy. I couldn't save Jennifer.
You should be thinking about saving yourself. If the real killer was here, and he might have been, then he could have killed you. She stopped crying then and looked at him.
Why didn't he kill me?
She asked, her face streaked with tears, turning the question over in her mind.
Why didn't he kill me? He had the chance, but he didn't.
Somehow, she didn't fit the profile. He went for young, petite, innocent girls, type B. They already knew that.
And who else?
What did the type A all have in common?
Something that she wasn't. Something she didn't have or didn't do.
She thought back to what Rosetta had told her. A good girl deserves her mother's heart. Mothers. That was it. He was killing mothers. 8:43 p.m. I need to clear my mind. I want to forget about mothers, those who are supposed to protect you, take care of you. I wouldn't be in this position now if she had done what she was supposed to do. But I have never been able to get my mother out of my mind. Even after she took her own life, unable to live without Elise, unable to live with the guilt of the fact that she had let the bastard into our lives, that she had brought the devil to our door. She hadn't been able to cope, and so my little sister had drowned. But it was his fault, even though she should have protected us, protected Elise. I wasn't there that day. I wasn't there to save my little sister. I remember coming home from school. It was a freezing cold February day, and the sky was already darkening. One of the mechanics, Martin, asked me what I'd learned about, if I liked my teacher. But then the bastard roared at me to get in the house. I wasn't to cause trouble in the yard. I remember clearly Martin frowned, and when the bastard had faced the other way, he winked at me. It wasn't until later that I heard that the bastard should have been in the house looking after Elise. He was meant to be taking care of her, but instead he was out in the yard with the other men, playing with his cars, bantering with the lads. He cared so little about us that he forgot. Forgot about the little girl that he should have been keeping safe. I shouted for Elise as I went through the door. She always used to come running to see me. One time, because my mother had been so out of it for the day and mustn't have fed her, I found her eating the dog's food from the bowl on the floor of the kitchen. That man always treated his dogs better than us. But this day, there was silence. I looked around the door of the room my mother shared with him. That day she was flat out on the bed. The doctor had given her some tablets to take to help her cope. Sometimes she took too many. Or she drank too much. Stuck her head in the sand. She should have been on her guard, but instead she spent days in bed. All because of the way he treated her. I think she wanted to escape from him any way she could. Some days she would sleep for hours on end, and Elise would curl up next to her while she was out of it. My little sister would sing or chat to herself, lying against my mother's semi-conscious body. Other days, Elise and I would hide from him, afraid that without anyone to witness, he would do what he liked to us. I checked my mother was breathing. Elise wasn't there. I went into my room and searched in the wardrobe, under the bed, anywhere a small child might hide from an angry, violent man. She liked to wrap herself up in a blanket to feel comfort, I suppose. But when I approached the bathroom, a growing dread began to fill me. The door squeaked on its hinge and then stopped as it banged softly on the radiator behind it. The house was silent except for a rhythmic drip, drip, drip that seemed to grow louder and fill my skull. I remember looking down at my feet as I slowly placed one in front of the other on the black and white tiles. I had to force my eyes to travel up the bath panel over the rim. Elise's tiny body lay suspended in the water, her pale, flawless skin whiter than ever, her blue eyes open. The surface was smooth, like glass. Her hair floated outwards like rays of light from the sun. At first, I didn't understand what I was seeing. I said, "Elise, Elise, stop missing. Get up now. You can't hold your breath like that for much longer." But when she didn't respond, I climbed into the bath with her. I remember the splashing and struggling as I tried to grasp hold of her. So difficult as the water made her slippy and she was heavier than I realised. "I wasn't strong enough to pull you out of the water, Elise, even though you were so small. Instead, I climbed into the bath with you and held your little body until the water was freezing. One last embrace before they took you from me forever." "I tried, Elise. I tried to come with you that day, but somehow I couldn't stay beneath the surface. My mother woke eventually. The look in her eyes when she realised you were dead. She blamed me. She thought that I had drowned my own sister, my own beloved Elise. But it was only because she couldn't bear to recognise the truth. But I wasn't a killer. Not back then. He wasn't even in the house the day that Elise died, but he caused it. He made my mother's life so bad that she put her own feelings above ours and zoned out. She never hurt us, but she left us. Maybe not physically, but she was absent. She wasn't there when it mattered. A good girl should have her mother's heart, have all the love that a mother can give. A child should be loved, shouldn't they? A mother's hands should be used for the good, for protecting a child, holding them, brushing their hair, picking them up when they fall, lifting them from the bath, wrapping a big towel around them and hugging them. That's what a mother's hands should do. I'm going to give Isabel the box now. It is time she took it to Elise." Chapter 36. Wednesday, 7th of February, 9:45 p.m. Kira burst into Tom's office. He was studying his screen and rolled his eyes when he saw her. She didn't care. Her priority was Isabel. She had convinced Jimmy that she was fine by the time they had arrived at her apartment block, and even gone inside and waited until he had driven away. But then she had got back into her car and driven straight to the station. "Tom, I've got information," Kira began, excited and breathless. He didn't move for a moment. His hair was ruffled, and he had a 5 o'clock shadow. When had he last slept? He got up slowly and closed the door behind her. "I think I know," she began. "Kira, sit down," he ordered. She did as she was told. There was no time to argue. "You look exhausted." He perched on the edge of his desk in front of her. She put her hand to her hair self-consciously. You should go home and get some rest. We're getting too close to the deadline, if he hasn't killed her already. She checked her comms watch. It isn't 10 o'clock yet. There's still 2 hours. He blew out a lungful of air. Listen to me. She stood up, and he leaned back away from her slightly. I think the murderer, he's killing women he perceives to be good girls, but also he's killing mothers. What was his expression? Sadness? Pity? Most of the victims didn't have children. He moved back behind his desk and slumped into his chair. No, I mean the first set of victims, type A. The unknown woman, Madeline, Amelia, Kaylee, Emma. Tiredness washed over his face. Madeline Cooper didn't have any children. His voice was flat. Had he given up already? Kira placed two hands flat on his desk and leaned over towards him. Her mother told us back at the time that Madeline had had a child when she was young and given it up for adoption at 6 weeks old. Madeline had a serious addiction and didn't feel as though she could parent a child. Her mother said in hindsight she was devastated that she hadn't adopted the baby herself because she had nothing left of her daughter once she was dead. It's on the files. Kira, this is desperation talking. What about the first victim, the unknown one? Why wasn't he looking at her? The post-mortem report says she showed signs of having given birth. We don't know what happened to that child. Kaylee Carmichael had a young son, Riley.
So what? They're all mothers,
Tom said, hands out in front of him. Plenty of the female adult population of their age are likely to be mothers. Why are you being like this? Why aren't you listening to me?
Look,
he snapped, leaning forwards over his desk, pointing a finger towards her. I am in the middle of an investigation. I don't need you coming in and... He stopped, his expression now confused or irritated, she couldn't decide. Anyway, where the hell are you getting all this information from? After the transference with Ray Clark, it led me to another witness, Rosetta Maguire. She remembered her promise. But Tom, you can't use her name. She'll have to be a Witness X. We need to keep her identity. Jesus Christ, Kira, you're not a police officer. It's not your job to solve crimes. Have you not had enough side effects to tell you that enough is enough? What are you doing to yourself? Alex came with me to see Rosetta. She's a police officer.
What?
He remained still for a moment, and she wondered if he had heard what she had said, but then he spoke into his comset.
Alex, get up here, now.
I've got to get to the truth, Tom.
And you call this the truth? You think... rummaging around in someone's brain for memories, which might or might not be real, is going to help to find out the truth.
He was shouting at her now.
Let me tell you, Kira, no one person holds the truth. We all see things differently from our own perspective for our own ends. We convince ourselves of what we see to back up what we believe. Even if this technology that you designed worked, we could never trust it. Even if we could access people's memories accurately, how do I know that the brain hasn't misinterpreted it? How do I know that you're not just telling me what you want to tell me, what you want to see? There is no objective truth, Kira.
He collapsed back into his seat.
I'm sorry I ever called you. I feel responsible that you're in the state you're in now.
This tech works, Tom. Rosetta doesn't want to be identified. Promise me you'll keep her identity secret.
This is bullshit, Kira.
Her comms watch beeped. Please, love, will you try Molly again? Have a look for her. I'm really worried now. Kira felt a rush of anxiety for her niece, but she had 2 hours left to try to save Isabel. After that, she would find Molly and try to make things right, once she had a chance to rid her system of all the alien thoughts and feelings that were invading her from the transferences. Alex appeared, pink in the face, and Tom stood up and squared up to her.
What the hell do you think you're doing? Going behind my back? Taking orders from someone else?
Alex looked like a child being told off by the head teacher, hands joined together, head down.
Going to some woman's house without my say-so? I told you yesterday you were in trouble. What the hell is the DCI going to say?
Alex turned to Kira, furious.
Are you trying to ruin my career? You said to keep this to ourselves, and now you're telling my boss?
The pair of you should have told me if there was another witness, Tom snapped.
You invited me into this, Tom, Kira retaliated. You asked me, remember? If you feel guilty because you missed a crucial witness, don't try to...
But he stopped. Her comment had hit home.
How many women could we have saved if someone had taken Rosetta seriously 15 years ago?
And this Maguire woman, Tom barked at Alex. Did she seem like a viable witness?
Kira held her breath. Was he going to take the lead and run with it? Was he going to interview Rosetta and use all the information that she had to catch him? Would they be able to find Isabel in time?
She had absolutely no idea what Kira was talking about. Alex shot her a glance.
No, but her husband was there. She didn't want to speak, Kira told Tom desperately. She doesn't want anyone to know that she was there. I told you, she contacted me today and told me the whole story.
I don't want to hear any more. Tom sat back in his seat.
If he sticks to the pattern, then tonight is the night she dies, Kira said. You've got nothing. Nothing besides what I'm telling you.
Yes, we have. He spoke calmly now. We're investigating a man called Martin Coombs, who worked as an apprentice for Lomax back in the early noughties. The DCI is on to the fact that you might be related to one of the victims, and there's no money left now in the pot for your fee. He paused. We don't need you anymore.
Don't need you anymore? I don't care about the money. We need to find Isabel, and now, Kira cried. We've got until midnight, and then it will be too late. He'll kill her.
We all want to find Isabel, Tom bellowed. You can't destroy yourself in the process. Get her out of my office, he commanded Alex. And then, Kira, you need to go home and have a rest, or I'm going to call an ambulance for you and get them to deal with you. He spoke firmly, pointing at her. I got you involved, and I'm sorry. I really am. I didn't realise it would have such an effect on you. But you have to leave it to us now.
But Tom, I...
Or I can arrest you. Get her out, Tom told Alex.
His eyes were fixed firmly back on his screen. Exhausted, Kira let herself be led. When they got to the main entrance, Alex paused.
You don't look well. Please don't cause any more fuss. Go home.
Another message came through on Kira's comset.
I'm worried sick. Please call me as soon as you can.
Kira groaned. There was nothing she could do to help Isabel now. She needed to focus on her family. She turned to Alex.
Please, do one last thing for me. My mum has messaged to say Molly's run off again. Please, trace her phone.
Alex locked eyes with her for a moment.
I promise, if you do this for me, I won't call you again.
There was a pause, and then Alex said, I thought we had an understanding.
I helped you, but you showed me up in front of the boss. I can't trust you, Kira.
She looked down at Kira's comms watch.
I'll do it for your mum, not you. But after this, I don't want to hear from you again.
She turned and went back into the station. Kira waited, agitated, in the main entrance on the other side of the security door. After 10 minutes, Alex returned. I found her phone. It's on Byram Street.
That was where the lab was. What was Molly doing there?
Had she gone to see if Kira was working late? She didn't know she'd lost her job, so it was possible. Kira ran to her car after mumbling a thanks to Alex. Moments later, she was driving towards the lab, hoping Molly would still be there when she arrived. She would give her a good talking to on the way back home.
A group of armed police officers were rounding up the Lye addicts, and the street supervisors were scrubbing up the refuse of the day as she turned off the main road and onto Byrom Street. Screeching to a halt outside the lab, Kira felt herself gearing up to a confrontation with Molly. But there was no one to be seen. She got out of the car and checked the door to Carter Tech, but it was locked. Graffiti on the walls opposite took on strange forms and shapes in the shadows, and a creeping dread filled her. "Call Molly." Her comset immediately lit up. There was a brief moment of silence, and out of the corner of her eye, a small light appeared, partially hidden by a rubbish bag, a couple of metres away from where she was standing. A split second later came the buzz and ringing. She moved the bag out of the way with her boot and looked down to the bright screen displaying the word, "Key." Her mouth dried up. Molly had been here. Oh God, I told her I was going to do an experiment to find out who killed her mum. I led her here. Her fingers fumbled as she scrabbled to pick it up, and her eyes caught a silver glint beneath it. Kira knew immediately what it was. A mitzvah. The killer had taken Molly. Hadn't she seen someone in the street by the lab watching her? But how had he known where she worked? How had he found Molly? "Call Alex." Alex answered after what seemed like ages. "What, Kira?" she said, her voice flat. "You weren't going to call. Please, Alex. He's got Molly." "What?" Her reply was muffled. Kira could hear the sound of Alex starting her car. "I don't want to talk to you. You've got me into enough shit." Kira's throat was closing up. Her lungs were suddenly restricted, her voice small. She whispered, "The mitzvah murderer. He's got my niece." In Kira's eyeline, Madeline Cooper, wrapped in eco-plastic, a black wound where her heart should have been, stood against the graffitied wall, her snake tattoo uncoiling, slithering from her thigh, up her torso, and through the hole in her chest. It squirmed out of her back across the bricks and blended in with the sprayed artwork. Had Alex even heard what she had said? "He's taken Molly. I found her comset with a mitzvah pendant." She reached out to her car door, the lock automatically reacting to her. She sat in the driver's seat, light-headed, chest heaving. "She's only run off again," said Alex, sounding bored. "You said yourself, she often goes off on her own. Go and have a sleep, Kira. You're losing it." She could hear Alex make her muffled comment to someone else and the sound of her engine. "Please, Alex. Look, Kira, we've got to get Coombs. He's the most likely suspect. The armed response team are already there. We're on our way now, so I've got more important things to worry about." There was a brief pause. "Molly will come home when she's ready." The call was disconnected. Kira started the engine and took the car to the junction, trying to decide whether to turn left or right. What was she to do? Where was she to go? Was there no one who would help her now? How was she going to find Molly? She rolled the car out slowly, but slammed on the brakes as an ambulance appeared from along the main road, lights but no sirens, and came towards the car at speed. As he drove past her, the perimed glanced in her direction. It was then that Kira remembered where she had seen the killer's face before. Chapter 37. 10:35 p.m. Isabel. Candles. There are so many candles. Gentle lights flickering on the ceiling, which seemed to stretch high, reaching up, up, up. That's where she can see them. Their wings wide and welcoming. The wings that will soon curl around her and lift her up. She wonders if it is an angel carrying her now. But then she sees his eyes and remembers. She hears a sound like feathers fluttering, a rhythmic swishing sound. Maybe she's already leaving her body, travelling through time and space, no longer held back by anything. no longer bound by the fear of what he will do to her or the attachment she once felt to the world. She can hear the angels singing, or maybe it is water flowing. For a fleeting moment, she thinks of her mother. She can feel her presence somewhere in the world as though they are connected, even though her mother is long gone. The hidden is becoming visible to her, her mind going beyond the physical. "We're coming to the end now," he tells her gently. "You mustn't worry. Everything is in place. Everything will be peaceful. The pure and innocent should not suffer. It will be painless, beautiful." And something in his voice convinces her that it will be beautiful. 10:37 p.m. It made sense now, what Rosetta had said. Rosetta, Witness X, the whole key to unlocking this case. When Rosetta had told her that an ambulance had come for Jenny's body, for a moment, Kira had teetered on the edge of disbelief. But it had been precisely the fact that her gut instinct told her loud and clear that Rosetta was truthful, that forced Kira to find an explanation. "The ambulance was driving away," Rosetta had said. The T-shirt with two snakes and a winged staff she had seen in Lomax's memory, the access to medical opiates and a sternal saw, a perimed pulling over to let her car into the eco-recycling centre 15 years before. She was sure of it now. The killer was a perimed. It was how he had chosen his victims. The burn on Riley's arm, Chloe had said his mother had had it checked over, and Rosetta said a perimed was called when her daughter was found unresponsive in her cot. Did he think these mothers didn't take enough care of their children, like his own mother maybe? Was that why he was punishing them? Even the second set of victims, the B-type good girls, Jessica Smith, a school teacher. Ambulances sometimes went to school when children hurt themselves or got sick, didn't they? Jennifer Bosenkay, a church youth worker. She'd be out visiting the people in her parish who were ill. Perhaps she had encountered him there. Amelia Brigham, a social worker. They dealt with perimeds regularly, she was certain. But, more importantly, he had the ideal form of transport. Kira imagined him bringing Madeline's body with him in the ambulance after brutally killing her elsewhere. He must have driven to the eco-recycling centre, placed her body at the foot of the slag heap of plastic, and then called it in himself. She knew from experience that, more often than not, ambulances arrived at the crime scene before the police got there. He could have called 999 for all of his kills, and when the control room radioed, guess who would be nearby? A ghost, Will had said. She imagined him sitting in the vehicle, watching the unfolding drama of his own creation. Best seat in the house. It was the perfect method. Hiding in plain sight. Someone who the victims would trust. Someone who could transport bodies. Someone the police wouldn't suspect. One of their emergency service brethren who had access to different vehicles, who had medical knowledge to drug his victims, who could get his hands on a sternal saw at the hospital. The more she thought about it, the more it made sense to her. "Dial Alex," she told her comset, and moments later she answered. "Alex, it's me." "Christ, Kira, I'm in the middle of a crime scene," she said as soon as she picked up. "Have you not got the message?" "Tell me one thing. Is Martin Coombs a perimed?"
"What?"
Kira could hear people talking on the other end of the line.
"Martin Coombs, is he a perimed? I think our killer drives an ambulance."
But Alex cut her off. "Martin Coombs is dead. CSIs did a forensic light source, a blue light, and there's blood all over the place. Coombs is wrapped in plastic in the fucking loft, so I'm a bit too busy for your bull.
So why don't you listen to me? I've got a new lead. The killer... he's a perimed. He drives an ambulance. I think his first name is...
Kira, I'm really not interested. You told Tom I went with you to see Rosetta when you promised you wouldn't.
It's your fault I'm on a warning. I'll never get a bloody promotion now.
Listen to me.
No. We've got a few hours to save Isabel, and I've got another dead body on my hands. Let us get on with it. Bye, Kira.
But he's got Molly, Kira begged. We've got to get to him before...
Tom's right about you. You're fucking mental. Kira opened her mouth to speak, but Alex had already cut the call. There was a split second when it could have gone either way, when everything that had happened seemed to rush at her all at once, and she might have been crushed under the weight of it. She might have crumbled in despair, fallen down a black hole of grief and helplessness, abandoned hope for a safe return for Molly and Isabel, given up. But then she thought of her niece, her golden eyes, her gorgeous smile, her mother's spirit still alive in her, of the promises she had made to Emma in the necroplex to look after Molly. There was another way. She scrabbled for Tom's police miniscreen that was still in her glove compartment and flicked it on, more determined than ever to show them that her tech worked, more determined than ever to get justice for Emma, but more importantly now, to find Molly. Less than 3 minutes later, she had located the statement of the first officer attending the crime scene at the Eco Recycling Centre in 2020. She scrolled through, looking for the name of the person who had called in Madeline Cooper's body. Unknown. Then she looked for first response details. She knew these reports didn't always have the name of the attending perimed. But in this case, it did. Stephen Fennig. Stephen. He had told Rosetta his real name because he hadn't expected her to live and tell anyone. He would have given his real name in the police report because he didn't think he would be caught. She commanded her comset to call April Butler, the human resources manager at the hospital, deliberately using her vid screen. She had been with Tom when they had gone to find Andrew Harper's information just days ago. The human resources officer would recognise her face, assume she was a police officer. Tom hadn't told her any differently. Kira would ask for the details of Stephen Fennig, just as they had done with Andrew Harper. It was late, but April Butler answered. Minutes later, Kira had all the information that she needed. Tom did not have faith in her tech. Alex doubted her sanity. Jimmy thought she was weak and couldn't handle the side effects. But she knew where Stephen Fennig was. She would save Molly, whatever it took. She would get justice for Emma. She would find Isabel. She would show Alex, Jimmy, and Tom. She would show them all. 11:08 p.m. Isabel. He lays her down carefully. The cold shocks her back into feeling her body, the surface hard and smooth beneath her. For a moment, she is alone with the lights, the angels, the voices. It is the most peaceful she had felt for a long time. When he reappears, he is carrying a red metallic gift box with a golden bow. It shines in the candlelight and makes her think of Christmas. She wishes he would go away. She wants to be alone, just her and the angels. But the second he speaks, the angels begin disappearing like bubbles popping. As a child, she read about near-death experiences, how there was a tunnel, a beautiful light at the end. She wants to fly away, be free from all pain, from Andrew, from time itself. Time that her grandmother had given her, marked out in the silver casing of a fob watch. She giggles. It seems so pointless now, a watch. Why count the time when she can be free from it altogether?
This is what you must do. Give these to Elise. Tell her I love her. Tell her I will be there one day. Look after her for me.
Where is she? Asks Isabel. Her voice sounds soft, slow. It is a buzz inside her own skull.
In the water, of course. You'll be with her soon.
What is this?
she asks sleepily as he places the box on her chest. She takes it awkwardly, the contents slide heavily inside.
Open it and see.
She thinks she might be smiling, like a child on her birthday, as she pulls the golden ribbon, feeling its silky softness until it pops open. Her arms are weak and heavy. Her fingers fumble with the lid until she manages to remove it and drop it to one side. From her prone position, she can't see what is in the box, and so she tips it towards her face. At first, her muddled brain can't recognize what she is seeing, can't make sense of it. Possibly some kind of huge red spider with a grotesque, viscous body. Her eyes narrow, trying to decipher it, but then, not able to hold the box steady, the bony, slimy mass slips onto her neck. The spider's legs wrap around her throat. She tries to shrug it off, reaching up to pull it away, but her fingers are numb, and she struggles to grasp it. When she manages to take hold, it comes away in pieces, the bloody mass slipping back onto her body, the spider's legs in her hands. She inspects them, trying to focus. The spider's legs have silver rings and fingernails painted black. The sound coming from her lips.
A mother's hands should be used for good, he says, crouching down next to her, smiling, his eyes bright,
as though she now understands. She lies trembling, the pair of severed hands grasping at her neck and shoulders. He removes the box and places the heart gently on her chest. Underneath it, her own heart beats furiously, pulsating through her ribcage, making the bloody mound appear to beat in time with her own.
Give this to my sister, he says, smiling. A good girl deserves her mother's heart.
And then the water